Books are incredibly powerful. They expose us to different ideas, different viewpoints, and new ways of thinking. They educate and they inform. They can help us cultivate empathy and a greater understanding of what it is to be human. I was thinking of all this when I was watching Orange is the New Black. There's this episode where all the books in their library need to be destroyed due to an infestation of bugs. I thought about the importance of books and how, in an environment like a prison, books are particularly precious. This inspired me to post a call for book donations to my Facebook page and take the collected books to a young offender center near where I was living at the time. But this is not a new idea. In fact, there are whole organizations dedicated to getting books to prisoners, a piece of restorative justice work that may seem small but has a much greater impact than we may realize. Today's collaborator is Andy Chan, a volunteer with Books to Prisoners in Seattle, Washington since 1994. In addition to sharing a bit about the history of the organization and his role within it, he talks about the greater social impact of this kind of work, including how to manage personal feelings so he can remain open to the humanity of the prisoners that he communicates with. Content notification, we do talk about some tough subjects. We're talking about prisoners and some of the crimes that they have committed come up, including sexual assault and murder. Hi, Andy. Thank you so much for collaborating with me on an episode of Everything is Workable.
Yeah, hey, I'm happy to be on. Do I call you Kate, or Kate is Kate? Or maybe I shouldn't call you anything.
Yeah, you can call me Kate or Caitlin. I'm annoying that way because I don't care.
Okay, all right. Hi, Kate.
So I do have an opening question, but first I'm actually going to ask, because you live in the States, you live in Seattle.
Yes.
But you do not have an American accent.
You are incredibly perceptive. I can see this. This is we're gonna have a great conversation here. I am from England originally, but I have been here like a really long time. I've been here almost 24 years.
Okay.
So it almost feels like I'm a native.
Whereabouts in England are you from?
Oh my gosh. I kind of code switch on this one depending on how well people know the country, but I'm assuming your various listeners, some are going to be incredibly well educated, so I'm going to mention my hometown and people are going to say, "Ugh, that's a horrible place to have been born and brought up," and I would agree with you. I was born in a town called Basingstoke, which is about 50 miles west of London. Mm-hmm. And is renowned for I think the only thing it's really renowned for is the number of roundabouts or traffic circles. It's famous for that, and that's about it.
I've driven through Basingstoke before.
Oh my gosh. Well, also you need to go on the train, because my friend who works for Rick Steves, who's a travel journalist, delights in whenever I mention my hometown, the fact that she goes through it on the train frequently and likes to announce Basingstoke. This is Basingstoke. So, yeah. So, another great thing about my hometown.
I actually do know a lot of places in the UK purely because I know about them being announced on the train. I'm like, I've never been there, but they announce it on that train. So I know it exists. Anyway, that was a fun digression. I just asked because I lived in the UK for 6 years.
Cool.
And I miss the wonderful abundance of British accents.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so my actual opening question is always just to ask my guests to share basically their activist origin story, if you will. So what was it that put you on the path of doing the work of social restoration?
Well, how long is the podcast again?
Don't worry, I can edit it for time.
Oh, excellent. All right. I'll give you the relatively, hopefully short version. So I'm not entirely white, and I was brought up in Basingstoke, as we just found out. Luckily, we just found that out, which is, at least when I was growing up, was a relatively white town. So I kind of experienced it as an outsider who didn't really feel like an outsider, but that people viewed me as an outsider. And going to school in England can be a rough experience, especially if you are not part of the crowd. I think it's slight, you know, other than the absence of guns, it's slightly less worse than perhaps American schools from my experience. So that kind of gave me a grounding in what it's like to not be oppressed necessarily, but to be part, to be a minority, and to be sort of not in, and things like that. So I think so that's the very genesis of where I came from. And me and my brother sort of traded off on a certain degrees of radicalization regarding social justice and political type things. There was lots of things, believe it or not, wrong in England and the world even back then. So I mean, we got into all kinds of various different things, like, you know, the anti-nuclear movement and animal rights stuff, hunt sabotage, anti-apartheid, you name it. We kind of got into it one way or another. And so I did various studies over in England. And then when I emigrated to America, kind of like the first thing I did when I got to Seattle was to go down to Left Bank Books, which is an anarchist bookstore, a venerable anarchist bookstore in Pike Place Market in Seattle, and ask them, so what should I be doing? And they said, go to Books of Prisoners. And so I did. And that's the, you know, sort of how I started on an incredibly long journey with this organization, you know, which is just a part of, you know, my social justice-y, radically kind of nature, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The whole Books to Prisoners thing is just, to me, I love it. I think it's just so fantastic to me. It feels like it's such a... I think that the word radical gets misused a lot, but it seems very radical purely because the mentality that somehow prison is about punishment rather than about rehabilitation. And
yeah,
yeah. I would love to hear a little bit about just about the organization and what its ethos is, if you will.
Yeah. Okay. So a little bit of a background and history. Basically, Books Prisoners came into existence sometime on or before 1973. It was essentially an activist reaction to the drift from, as we move from the 60s into the 70s, of you know, moving from the open student type movements to the more secretive organizations doing expropriations, let's call them, and things like blowing up transformers and things like that. I can't remember exactly the name of the organization, but they were in Seattle, but they were allied with some of the Black Panthers here in Seattle. And, you know, some folks got themselves into prison one way or another. And so supporters on the outside said, we need to support them. So, you know, essentially the organization started as a prisoner support organization for political prisoners. And then, you know, in the intervening 45 plus years, whatever it is now, it's kind of like grown and developed and broadened, certainly into, I mean, I think relatively early on into a more general organization, understanding the importance of literacy and education for people on the inside who, for one reason or another, may not have had an instinct for learning or a desire to read up to this point. I mean, obviously there's a lot of folks who in prison who have always loved reading, but an incredible number of folk we get who you know, just basically learning to read, or they haven't read any books outside of ones that they might have had to pick up in school, and, you know, they didn't finish school and things like that. So I think I've digressed a bit there, haven't I, from the actual question? But
no, it was a good digression. I think as well that the understanding the way that people can be limited in their choices and options and opportunities, and as what you said earlier about the school systems, right? And if you have a school system that isn't set up to foster an environment where reading is fun or interesting or cool.
Yeah, yeah. And how many people's experience has been that they're schooling has been fun and, you know, has left them with a desire to learn. It's just a lot of kids who haven't had that experience. Oh, but I should get back to the actual question, which is a bit more background on books of prisoners. Sorry, I remembered what the question was now. So basically, ever since its inception up until 2013, 2014, we were an all-volunteer organization, you know, growing from however many few letters we sent in the 1970s to 12 to 15,000 requests a year now. The books we send are to prisoners all over the United States and some associated territories. And we send them free of charge, except where prisons demand that or say that their prisoners cannot get free books, in which case we charge a minimal fee of like a buck or something, so that they can actually tell their mail rooms that they did buy these books rather than get them free. And, you know, it started out in Seattle as one of the first, possibly the first prison book type organization of a secular nature, at least. And since then, we have created branches in Olympia and Portland, Oregon. And we had one in Bellingham until a couple of years ago. And we just started a new branch in Spokane. And there's some interest from some folks in Ashland as well. So, it's grown a lot. Oh, and I should also say that, yeah, I mean, we were all volunteer up until, you know, kind of an interesting moment in 2013. I mean, it's always been a very low income organization, which is run primarily off of individual donations. And then in 2013, there was a lawsuit against AT&T, the phone company, for screwing the families of prisoners in Washington State by overcharging massively on collect calls, because when prisoners want to get a hold of their loved ones who aren't in prison, they have to make a collect call, which is charged to prisoners' families. And they were ripping off these prisoners' families. There was a lawsuit, and there was a multi-million-dollar settlement by AT&T. And after they had refunded prisoners' families and things like that, there was a chunk of money left over. And the courts asked different organizations, prison and prisoner type organizations, if they would request some money. So we requested some money, and we were able to afford, when we got that money, a part-time coordinator. So we are not entirely volunteer, although we are still extremely volunteer driven, and all of the key people in the organization are still volunteers and presumably will be forever and ever and ever. But we have one part-time staffer as well.
So the American criminal, and I'm putting this in quotes, justice system is, to put it mildly, really not great.
That is the mild version, yes.
Really, yeah. Like, there's lots of problems with it, socially, economically, systemically, lots of problems. It's a hot mess. And with any hot mess, knowing how to approach it and what kind of solutions, like, there is never just a single answer to any complex problem. And actually, usually thinking there's a single answer just adds to the problem. But I'd love to hear a bit about how having access to books is a valid approach and does create solutions. Like, how is this an effective way to address some of the issues of America's prison system?
You're absolutely right. I mean, we all recognize that what we do is, you know, just the tiniest fragment of importance regarding the entire criminal justice system. Providing books and encouraging reading is super important in lots of lives, if not every life. But, you know, in terms of the gigantic mess, as you say, hot mess of the American criminal justice system, it's a tiny fragment. we like to hear about some of the other organizations that that work in on remediating some of the problems. And that's kind of how we view what we're doing. We're kind of trying to correct some of the things that have already happened. So there's university behind bars and some education stuff in prison, out of prison, providing books, providing literacy kind of stuff. Those are all kind of things that we try and do without addressing the bigger problem. And that's, partly that's obviously because the bigger problem is just so gigantic. It's a systemic problem that requires a systemic solution. One thing that I certainly was gratified by in, let's call it the Obama years, was the growing interest in prison issues that I hadn't really noted nearly as much in sort of like the previous 10, 15 years. Things like Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow really brought, brought the profile of the prison system to a much broader audience than might, previously had been paying attention. We sort of had spent lots of time and energy trying to get our name out and address things. And in liberal Seattle, we reach a fair number of people. But it was amazing. We'd go and table, at the University District Street Fair, or at we had Alice Walker come and do a talk for us one time. And every time we do some kind of event, we get lots of even, liberal Seattleites coming up to us and saying, we've never heard of you. And it's like, but we've had articles in the UW Daily and in Real Change and in the Seattle Weekly. And we've been mentioned multiple times in The Stranger and I think maybe once in The Times. But sort of it's just such an issue that it's just really easy to gloss over, despite it being such a gigantic problem. And I don't know, again, if your listeners know just how gigantic it is. I'm guessing they're an incredibly well-educated set of folks. But, we have a system in America which is – it's number one. It is number one. It's number one in, like, the number of people who are incarcerated, at least the rate, there's over 2 million people incarcerated in the United States. Per capita, it's by far the largest population of prisoners in any country in the world. And as you alluded to earlier, the disproportionate disposition of prisoners in terms of race is shocking. And again, again links up to Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow and sort of like how black people are so incredibly disproportionately featured as prisoners as compared to their in the general population. But yeah, so oh gosh, this is a long-winded answer to your question. So yeah, I mean, it's a gigantic problem. Books to prisoners can only seek to do a little bit, but I mean, it's sometimes those little things that make a big difference to individuals. It's like that allegorical story of the guy who's throwing jellyfish back into the sea, and the other guy comes up and says, yeah, there's millions of them on the beach. What does it matter if you throw it? You can't get them all. And you say, no, I can't. We can't get all of these jellyfish, or I can't get all of these jellyfish, but it makes a difference to that one jellyfish that I threw back. So although we're a tiny fragment of what we hope is a solution, it can be a gigantic part of a solution to that individual there, or that individual there, or that individual there.
Yeah, no, the individual impact and appreciating that, because they're part of that bigger system that in itself is where the change starts to happen. How do you measure success as an organization?
It's really tough. Definitely. I mean, we have our metrics about how many requests we get, how many books we send out, how many volunteers we have, all those kind of things. But they don't. I mean, that tells you the output of what we do. It doesn't necessarily tell you the outcome, and we don't have quantitative statistical data about the difference that we make. What we have is, there's anecdotal stories. which I certainly find are incredibly meaningful in doing the work that I do, and has allowed me to continue to do this for 24 years now, essentially. Because you know how probably the last thing you want to do when you get out of prison is to remember the things that you were doing and the things that you needed in prison. You want to go out, presumably, and, you know, get back to live your life, to experience stuff, and just put that behind you. So we don't expect people to write to us, to donate to us, or any of that kind of stuff. I mean, I totally get the idea. If it was me, shoot, I would just be out and just live my life as best as I could. So it's actually incredibly frequent how we get letters from people saying either that they are just about to be released or they just were released, and that they wanted to say just how important it was that we sent them books. And it can be for a variety of different reasons. It could be because they needed a book to get them started on a new educational thing, or they needed this book because they were bored out of their skull and they didn't do anything else. I don't know, they were gonna do something bad. So those kind of things. And there's the humanity part of it, just that, hey, I didn't have, or I don't have anybody on the outside. I've been disowned by my family. I've been disowned by my friends. You guys were the only people who sent me anything that kind of reminded this person of their humanity. That's the kind of thing that makes an incredible amount of difference. And it was also gratifying, as this guy named Paul Wright, he is the founder of an organization which puts out this legal newspaper for prisoners called Prison Legal News. He founded it while he was in prison, and he's been incredibly influential in getting some things changed in, you know, mostly by legal means in a number of different places. Just recently, Nevada, I think it was a lawsuit, or it was either threat of a lawsuit or a lawsuit, and he got them to remove the incredibly intense restrictions that they had on books coming from outside organizations. But he just recently was approached by the Manchester Guardian from England to say what book made a difference to him, what book changed his life. That was it. Mm-hmm. And he mentioned that it was a book that we had sent him. So, mm-hmm. you know, back in in the early 80s or something, or the late 80s, we had sent him a book that had changed his life. And here's a guy who in return has made an incredible difference to the people around him and to education and to literacy for prisoners in a bunch of different places.
Yeah, the whole paying it forward thing. I was just thinking about what you're saying about how having anecdotal stories and experiences like that one, right, is very meaningful. And I think that a lot of the time anecdotal stuff gets dismissed, but as somebody who worked in charity and not-for-profit, and I understand what it's like when you, you can't necessarily have a good KPI when you're doing things like trying to raise awareness about something. For mm-hmm. example, like, how do you measure raising awareness? Honestly, getting those anecdotal stories is a big part of it. But I really would love to hear, like, for you, you said that makes it really meaningful. You've been doing this work for years now. What are the other things that keep you going? What are the key things that keep you going and keep you sticking out? Because I think the other thing, especially in an organization that's completely volunteer, you will face burnout.
Yes, yeah. Probably a character flaw on my part that I sometimes find it difficult to let go of things. But, you know, getting into it, part of the reason for me getting into it and sticking to it was a recognition that prisoners in general are not the cuddliest, most sympathetic crowd. A lot of the folks in prison have done some pretty awful things to other people. But I mean, sort of, they are exactly the kind of people that someone like me needs to help, because while I might be more interested in helping out kittens or things like that. There's a lot of other people who are willing to do that and will get something out of that very easily and that can sustain them. And I think there's a much smaller number of people who are willing to take on the harder, the dirtier, the less sympathetic situations like prisoners are. They're not always terribly sympathetic folks. So I thought that's the kind of thing that sustains me, is knowing that it's incredibly important work that needs to get done and someone's got to do it. And if not me, then who is going to do it? I mean, it's great. It's fantastic. We get like dozens, scores, if not hundreds of people coming through as volunteers each year at our space in Seattle. But, you know, I mean, a lot of folks have a lot of different commitments and then they not going to stop in and do the kind of work that is necessary to keep an organization going. And, you know, I think I just think it's so important to get this done that I stick to it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking when you mentioned earlier about the prisoner who said that it was like a way to connect with their humanity, by having books and being able to read, like, it sort of keeps them, having people acknowledge their humanity, right? And like, that's the work you're talking about doing, is that understanding that compassion. And I sometimes get into very bizarre conversations with people where they're like, oh yeah, I can be really compassionate when I'm in a good place, but when I'm not in a good place, it's really hard for me to cultivate that compassion. And then they say, you know, there's sort of a level of privilege to being able to be compassionate. And I was like, last time I checked, the most privileged people in the world seem to be the least compassionate people, actually.
Yeah.
What is your practice of reminding yourself of that humanity? Because you're right, like, you can hear some really difficult things. I worked with a youth in care and custody for a while. It was my first job. And I remember, like, most of the kids we were working with were wards of the province, and, you know, their circumstances were that their parents just could not parent for them if their parents were even around anymore. But we had a small group of kids that we worked with who were wards of the state because they had committed crimes, and some of them had committed some really uncomfortable crimes. Like, you're like, oh, you're here because of sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. And there's that sort of understanding the circumstances. And so what's been your experience of learning things about some of the people that you're helping? And like, how do you do that work of keeping a really open, compassionate heart to keep doing this work and be like, you are still worthy of redemption. You're worthy of respect as a human being.
Yeah, no, it's really tough. And for me, it helps that I work-wise come from a background of helping people. I'd done sort of a bunch of social service type jobs for a long period of time, and in doing that, again, another one of those things which is incredibly high burnout, and in order to maintain over the long run, which is what we all need to do. I mean, anybody who's in any kind of progressive kind of thing, social justice, needs to be able to do marathons, not sprints, is balance. Mm-hmm. It's caring, but not caring. I mean, this sounds kind of a bit weird, but it's not caring too much. If you care too much, if you take too much investment in an individual case or an individual situation or a series of them over a period of time, it just will fry your emotions, fry your ability to be objective, or even sometimes to the extent of frying your compassion. You just can't care any longer. So balance right from an early stage in what you're doing is super important. And I'll give you we have so many tough examples because, again, you know, most of the prisoners don't tell us why they're in prison. Mm-hmm. Some do. Some readily admit that they've done some pretty terrible things. Certainly have had a bit of correspondence with some murderers and, yeah, rapists, and you just kind of like, this is it. This is a human being. They made a terrible choice, and, or, you know, they had a terrible background, but no matter what they've done, they like it or not, they're still a human being and they are still capable, as you say, of some degree of redemption. They can be better. You know, even if the prison system is never, ever going to let them out, they can still be a better person. So something that happened in the last, certainly in the last, I think last 18 months, was that we got a request for books from a person who's in prison for life, and they raped and murdered one of our former volunteers.
Wow. And that's intense.
Seriously, I mean, just right now, I'm just thinking about it. It's like, you know, I have to take some deep breaths, because I saw the name and I recognized the name, because, you know, it's a fairly famous case. And it was just, wow, he probably has absolutely no idea that that one of his victims volunteered with us. Mm-hmm. He has no idea. But it doesn't matter. It, you know, I mean, sort of after I've gotten over just like the shock of seeing the name, I recognize it doesn't matter. It's one of those situations that people who are, for instance, opposed to the death penalty, and, you know, it's one of those horrible things when they have to think, or maybe they experience, a loved one who is murdered. Are their convictions strong enough to stick by them? And you know, what's important is that, you know, a lot of the folks will say, no, I'd probably want to tear them apart with my hands. I know I heard that on the radio, somebody saying that, just, I think, in response to the shooting at the school recently. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the kind of society that we live in, even if I have that intense desire to get retribution on the person who did this, I shouldn't do that. And my friends and my loved ones should make sure I shouldn't do that, because it's not okay. It's not okay. Mm. So it took me a little bit of thought to deal with, and then recognize, you know, the work is still important, and it applies to people who've affected people we know as much as people that we don't know.
Because books are so, they can be so transformative, right? Like, you mentioned The New Jim Crow, and I read that about a year and a half ago, I think now. And that shifted my perspective in a way. I already understood that there was a disproportionate number of Black people in prison, but suddenly I understood why. And, mm-hmm. and I also started to understand so much better why it's really obnoxious to say, you know, you shouldn't be angry. Like, you know, uh-huh. I get why you're angry. I totally get why you're angry. I'm actually really impressed that you're not more angry. I think it's really commendable that you're not more angry. and so there's that thing about how, like, when you read a book, like, I am never going to physically know what it feels like to be a Black person in America. Mm-hmm. But reading that book opened my eyes to an experience in a way that like, basically reading that book was the only way it could have opened my eyes to that experience, right? Like, I can listen to people's stories and stuff, but there's something about having it all collected in a book and presented in that way where you just, it's like, yeah, it's like transformative. And so it's, again, it's that what you're saying about the humanity and relating to people, and it's going, okay, well, my wanting to see that redemption, or my wanting to have that revenge, right? Like, how is it any different? How am I any different from this person who is mm-hmm. requesting this book? And I can see how it's changed my life to read certain things. And so actually, if I do want to have some sort of, like, it's not even necessarily revenge. It's like going, if I really do want this person to be less of a threat, then help them transform. And books mm-hmm. help you do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What kind of books do you think are the most powerful? And I don't mean like practical. I mean, like, what are books that you think are really powerful and have that transformative quality?
Oh, gosh. Funnily enough, I mean, and it's crazy to say, but the most powerful book is the one that we send out the most, or the one that we get the most requests for. And it's a dictionary. a simple English dictionary is by far the largest, most requested item that we get because it helps people understand. It really is as simple as that. I mean, I could try and muse about all kinds of other books that people have requested and have made a big difference to them. But I mean, just by, if nothing else, sheer volume, the dictionaries that we send out is the most powerful book that we have.
Amazing. That doesn't make sense, right? Expand your vocabulary, your understanding of the world.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there's other, I mean, that is a serious answer actually, but I mean, there's clearly a bunch of different books. I mean, we get such a wide variety of requests from the incredibly banal to the immensely educative kind of subjects that people are asking for. And each person has a different level or a different idea of what they hope to get out of these things. So it's really kind of difficult to say this book here or this subject here is the one that makes the biggest overall difference to people, because, you know, maybe it's that Danielle Steele that we sent to someone that finally got someone to start reading when they hadn't read stuff before. Maybe that's more important than some guy who gets a GED book or some guy who learns how to do heating, ventilation and air conditioning through a book that we sent them. It's different stages that people are at, and it's incredibly difficult beyond that to say what is the most important thing.
So my final question is always just, it's really just opening the floor for you for what kind of advice or guidance that you'd like to leave for listeners who are doing this kind of work or anything similar.
Oh my God, that makes it sound like I know what I'm talking about. Which, so yeah, anything I say, probably big caveat that I'm just BSing.
It's a very English thing for you to say. I think you should know, even though you've been living here for a long time.
Thank you. Oh no, I'm super important, and whatever I say, listen to it and take it away. Gosh, I would say try and do the things to help out the people that nobody else wants to help out, and dig deep into your soul as to where that is and who that is and what you can give, because the civilians out there, the folk who can do things just on the weekend, and, you know, let them do the easy stuff. You know, the folks who listen to your podcast are perhaps the folk who need to do the heavy lifting. And that's the stuff that sometimes the thankless stuff, sometimes the stuff that no one else wants to do. Do that.
Awesome. Thank you so much. This has been brilliant. And I will leave lots of details in the closing of the show so everybody knows how they can support your organization.
Fabulous. Thank you, Kate.
Thanks so much.
Books to Prisoners in Seattle aims to foster a love of reading behind bars, encourage the pursuit of knowledge and self-empowerment, and break the cycle of recidivism. To get involved or find out more, visit bookstoprisoners.net. To learn more about my work in the world, visit caitlinschatch.com. Along with more episodes of Everything is Workable, you can find my blog, books, and art. You can also become a patron or leave a tip to help support the things that I do. This episode of Everything is Workable was made possible through the patronage of Gretchen Wagner, Julian and Shannon Hatch, Winita Budgen, and Margaret Prescott, among others. Thank you to Tajai Moore of More Music for the original theme song.